You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Damien Francis. Joining us to break down the week in media and marketing is Tim Burrows.
Hey, Damo.
Brittany Rigby.
Hello.
Zoe Wilkinson.
Hello.
And Xander Wilson.
Hello.
Later in the Mumbrella Cast, Xander will be chatting with head of the Triple M Network, Mike Fitzpatrick, about new breakfast shows and a brand new radio station, plus a look ahead to the first rating survey of the year. But first, it's been a week of chief executive appointments, nine named stands Mike Sneesby as CEO, and multiple appointments at Adlander, UM, Ogilvy, Leo Burnett and Havas. Hugh Mark's successor as Nine CEO has been revealed to be Mike Sneesby in a media event held by Chairman Peter Costello at its headquarters in North Sydney on Wednesday. Sneesby, the CEO of Nine streaming service Stan, will take the helm in April, with Mark's remaining available to assist in the transition. The announcement saw Nine's share price at a new record high of $3.07, a market capitalisation of $5.3 billion. Tim, you were at the event on Wednesday. How was the vibe there?
Yeah, look, it was one of those ones where, as these things always happen, you want it to be, you plan for it to be a surprise, and it always comes out a few minutes early. So as we were all gathering, I think the Australian Financial Review was the first one to get the report that it was indeed Mike Sneesby. So that happened maybe 20 minutes or half an hour before we kind of went and took our seat in the big new studio in Nine's headquarters. I can't remember if it's called Studio A or not. Presumably it is Studio One or Studio A. And I'd say there were probably about 20 people or so in the room, you know, some mixture of journalists, and obviously they threw some production levels at it, so there were a few sort of camera people because they were live streaming it. I saw a couple of makeup artists leaving as we were on the way in, so I think they'd given them the whole powder puff treatment as well beforehand. But yeah, so the vibe by the time it started, though, and the chairman Peter Costello and Mike Sneesby actually walked out, everybody already knew the choice was Mike Sneesby. So there wasn't the big reveal as such.
Considering the fact that they called the conference only a few hours ahead of it, that was a decent turnout in COVID times to get everyone into the studio. But I think one of the big questions coming up will be, what's this shortish transition period going to be like, the month of March, before Sneesby really takes over? Did they detail that at all, Tim?
Well, he talked about the fact that he'll be stepping up on April the 1st, and a few times there were kind of sort of detailed questions for him, and the answer was very much, well, I'm going to be spending the next few weeks getting my head around it. I guess the key things for him are a much closer understanding of the publishing side of the business, closer understanding of the broadcasting side of the business, and of course closer understanding of Domain, of which Nine is still the major shareholder. And of course that's a big sort of source of their wealth as well. So a lot for him to get up to speed. Now, we'll maybe talk about it later in the conversation, but the fact that Hugh Marks isn't very well at the moment, his predecessor, presumably that may change the handover in some way as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also to bring in the other people in this situation as well, and I might throw to you here, Britt, because I know you've been looking at this a lot. Mike Sneesby is stepping into a business that has a few people in it who we thought were in contention for the role as well. The names that had been touted quite widely, Michael Stevenson, Lizzie Young, Chris Jantz, of course. Are they going to stay at Nine? Will this be quite a smooth transition? What's the market saying at the moment? What are we hearing?
The million-dollar question, Damo.
Questions.
Yeah, I think that's the big challenge that Mike faces pretty much from the get-go, right? And this isn't a reflection of, you know, Michael Stevenson, Lizzie Young, Chris Jantz's kind of approach or mindset at all. But the nature of it is, if they feel like they're in a position to take on a CEO role or to take a promotion or to really step up, and that hasn't happened, you know, it's a natural question to be asking, well, will they try and get that elsewhere? The hard part is that there's not much happening elsewhere. What other jobs would they step into? So, look, I think that that's almost a question for Sneezeby to start trying to figure out with them directly and trying to get them on board really quickly and trying to, you know, the three of them, Jance, Young, Stevenson, have worked quite closely together as part of that main nine business. Sneezeby's been a bit of an outsider to the market, kind of operating a little bit on his own, you know, at Stan. So I think his first, you know, priority really needs to be getting them on side, getting a sense of, you know, what they want out of his leadership, what they, you know, see as the future of Nine, and then trying to, you know, really keep that executive team stable, particularly as, you know, the board tensions continue to attract attention and there's potential instability at that level.
Peter Costello was obviously quite adamant that those tensions didn't exist, or a bit of a figure of the media's imagination. Tim, do you have any more sort of insight into just how real those tensions are?
Well, I must admit, I was a bit mean in the way I kind of structured my... I got to ask the first question in the press conference, and I was a bit mean in how I structured the question, and I sort of put it to him that I've just read in the Sydney Morning Herald that the board is fractured, because, of course, it's a bit hard for him to complain too hard about his own newspaper's reporting.
He did admit that as well, didn't he? He was very careful to say that that was obviously their brand.
Yeah, he acknowledged that Nine is a media company itself, so you can't really complain about the weather in that extent. He was insistent that the board was united. I noticed that he definitely at no stage when he was talking about the choice of the board talked about them being united. He did not talk about them having voted unanimously. And from all of the reporting we'd seen beforehand, I think probably there was more than one choice amongst the board, because it seemed to come down to three people. You know, as Britt was saying, you know, Chris Jans was still in the running towards the end, and then there was at least one external candidate in Carl Fennessy, you know, sort of from the production sector. And it may be in the end that, you know, Mike Sneezeby was in some way a sort of compromise candidate amongst the whole board. But, you know, I guess if there's a couple of circumstances that made it not perfect for Nine in making the announcement, it was the fact that there are suggestions of this sort of the old guard of the board, the Nick Falloon side that had come through Fairfax, and the kind of the Nine side of the board, obviously led by Peter Costello, not being completely aligned. Now, that's really bad news for a CEO. You know, I'm going to try not to be too boring, and for the next few months, every single one, when I was writing my book, but when I was writing my book, one of the things that really became obvious was every success story over the last decade, and there have been some, has been when the CEO has been backed by a completely united board. It's a prerequisite of success. I can't think of any examples where a divided board has still succeeded. So it's really important they sort that out. And then I guess the other, you know, kind of less than ideal circumstance, but clearly nobody's fault, was with Hugh Marks being unwell in hospital with what they said was some form of infection, wasn't obviously there to do, you know, to do the handover. So look, you know, I've seen much worse starts. You know, I think of Michelle Guthrie when she did her first interview as the boss of the ABC, where, you know, I never measured how many times she used the words, you know, but it was a lot. Whereas there were several times when Costello stepped in and took questions that were firstly aimed to Mike Sneezeby. But when Mike did talk, he was erudite. He was able to speak intelligently, but also very clear that he's still coming up to speed. So, you know, I think it's probably too soon to start forming views on that part of it yet. But it wasn't a perfect handover.
Yeah, and I think what I thought of when you were chatting there, Tim, is that, you know, he's coming into a company that's very different to the company that Hugh Marks stepped into. You know, there was multiple references to the fact that Nine was a $1 billion company, which is where Stan is now when Mark started. Now it's $5 billion worth. So in terms of, you know, he's stepping into a company that's in a great position financially and in terms of success and dominance. But there's always also, you know, a lot further for him to fall should it not go well, should the board continue to kind of, you know, have reports in their own papers that things aren't as peachy as Peter Costello might like us to believe.
Yeah, I wonder whether regardless of the rights and wrongs, and the fact that there was some sort of reporting of question marks about golf club membership with Nick Falloon, which I think went back to his Fairfax days. It feels like pragmatically, maybe it's just going to have to be time for him to leave the board.
And it sounds like that decision was mentioned yesterday by Peter Costello, that decision hadn't been made of the CEO until mid last week. We were all expecting maybe it would come out around the financial results, but clearly it was a lot closer to the wire than what it actually was. The one big question that it leaves now is who's going to be CEO of Stan, an extremely successful business in its own right. Britt, you've been exploring that a bit. Have you heard anything about what the transition phase is now for Stan?
Well, I think when Sneasby was announced yesterday, one of the first questions was, you know, will they replace him? And I think
it was me who asked the question.
Tim, I was going to say it. You asked the question that is he going to continue leading that strategy, or will he find a replacement? And I very much enjoyed watching the live stream when the room erupted in laughter when you said, well, will the new CEO have the freedom that you have had in that role? And all we know at this stage is that there will be a new CEO appointed. I don't know, you know, who that could be. I don't really have a good feeling about, you know, picking a name out of that key executive team that Sneasby's got in place there. Tim, I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that.
Well, look, I certainly got the impression that he felt it would probably be an internal candidate.
Yeah, definitely.
And I found myself thinking the other sort of general question about Stan that's going to be interesting anyway is it sprang to life as a joint venture between Fairfax and Nine, which was before the merger. But it carried on running as its own thing. And I think part of that was strategic because they were probably open, maybe they still are, to the idea that maybe they'd sell a 25% or 50% share potentially to one of the, you know, one of the kind of studios out of the US or something to guarantee the sort of, you know, the content in the future. So I think one of the questions will be, is that still a strategic option, or is it time for Stan to become a much greater part of the Nine culture? So that's going to be fascinating, really, because, you know, we've now obviously got Mike Sneasby, who lives and breathes Stan, running Nine. So if it doesn't come in, then to me that's a real signal that they are still open to selling a stake in the future.
Coming up next, more chief executive appointments in Adland. Nine was not alone in naming new CEOs this week, with UM Ogilvy Havas and Leo Burnett Sydney all appointing new leaders. For IPG Media Brands UM, Anathea Rise will be returning to Australia to take the top job following the announcement that Fiona Johnston would be taking an international role at the holding company in London. Britt, you've been on top of this one. It's a big move for UM. Fiona Johnston had brought a considerable amount of solidarity to UM and consistency to UM. What does this change mean? And did we think that Anathea Rise was in contention from the get-go?
Yeah, I think she was an interesting appointment, obviously, has been in America for a while and is coming back. I mean, importantly, Johnston is from the UK originally, so it does signal, you know, getting closer to family, going back home. That's part of it, in addition to the job title and the elevation itself. I think, you know, Johnston's incredibly well respected in this market. She's done a lot for UM and that agency. I think, you know, there's still a ways to go in it being considered in the same breath as an initiative, which I think is a lot more brash and kind of market focused and forward in terms of promoting itself. So I think it will be interesting to see if Rise continues that, you know, understated, head down, bum up, get the job done, but don't make too much of a big deal out of it kind of approach, or if she has a different approach. Again, you know, she's not a complete unknown to the market, but she's an unknown in that CEO role in that market, in this market.
Which is interesting, of course, though, because UM originally, way back when with Matt Baxter as CEO, you would have argued that was the brash in your face agency that was doing pretty cool and interesting things. An initiative at that time was very, very low key. What is IPG, what's Mark Code looking for here in terms of UM moving forward?
Maybe you're talking about the Matt Baxter effect there, because, you know, he became hopped over to Initiative, has this week also been promoted to chair of Initiative and has stepped out of that global CEO role. I think, you know, Mark Code, again, someone who has gravitas, has a reputation in this market, isn't a Matt Baxter figure, isn't as outspoken as Matt Baxter, but, you know, works very, very closely with Lee Terry, who's in that APAC role. They're very good friends. So I think Mark Code's vision for this market is very similar to what Lee Terry's vision for this market is, and that's consistency and growth. I think that Initiative and UM can have slightly different reputations and slightly different offerings and slightly different things that come to mind when you think of each of those brands, because of course, you know, they're led by different people and they're going to have different clients and all of the rest of it. But I think that, you know, it's less about, you know, Mark Code's vision revolutionizing what they do, and more about whether or not I think Rise continues on from Johnston's approach or shakes things up a bit.
Yeah, and I think you make a really good point mentioning some of the people who've sort of come before or contributed, because of course I think any agency actually sort of imbues into it little parts of the culture from different people, you know. So you go back to when, you know, as Universal McCann, as it was, an Initiative where we're kind of running their own races. And then Henry Tager was the sort of one who put it together and became IPG Media Brands chair, was his title, but then became executive chair and sort of almost ran it as one before going off overseas, taking Matt Baxter with him to that role. And then when, you know, when Henry left the organisation in the US, by then Matt had stepped up to this Initiative role. As a side note, it's really fascinating. There's a part of this story that can't be told yet, because Matt won't just go off to be chairman. There's something bigger coming along, because he's, you know, he's super hungry, he's super, you know, super talented, super thoughtful. So I wonder what the big role is that's being lined up for him. Certainly feels like there's something in the sidelines there. But you know, then locally, as you say, you know, we've got this culture which it's starting to look more and more like an Omnicom culture, really, because you've got Lee Terry came across. You've got this slightly weird thing where they've swapped places. So, you know, when I first knew Mark Code and Lee Terry, Mark was Lee's boss rather than the other way around. Doesn't seem to bother them. They all have their own roles and they sort of do them. But you know, it's kind of it feels like it's kind of a slightly I'm trying to find the right word, because I don't want to sound negative about them, but it's a kinder, gentler organization now than perhaps the sort of, you know, the in your faceness of it it's sometimes been at times with IPG.
We'll move on to some of the other changes that we've seen recently, and looking into WPP AUNZ, where Ogilvy Managing Director Sally Kassane was named as its new CEO, and she replaces David Fox, who at the same time is going to be moving to another role in the group in the Middle East. Zoe, you guessed that the new CEO for Ogilvy would come from within the network. So what does this change to Ogilvy mean? Because, of course, they've renamed or rejigged it slightly. It's now Ogilvy Australia Network that they're creating as well.
Yeah, so it didn't really come as a surprise to me at all that they hired their CEO internally. Like we said a couple of weeks back, Ogilvy had a number of managing directors, I think there were four, who had all either been with Ogilvy or with WPP for, you know, around 10 years each. Sally Kissane, who was made CEO, has been with Ogilvy since 1996 overseas and then became the MD in Sydney in 2018. Yeah, I've had a number of people say to me fairly recently that retaining the top talent is going to be a huge issue for WPP and for CEO Jens Monsees as he continues to go through this transformation plan, making moves to bring agencies together, whether that be for a financial reason or whether it be so that the group can continue to evolve. I mean, you can look as far back at the mergers of the White Agency and Grey Group, Y&R and VML and Wunderman and JWT, all of those CEOs have now left. And looking back at my chat with Jens Monsees from a couple of weeks ago, I think it did emerge talent is becoming an issue that is on his horizon. So to be clear about the formation of the Ogilvy Australia Network, that's bringing together Ogilvy Health, Ogilvy the creative agency and OPR. There's no one leader of that. So together there's Sally Kissane. Richard Brett, the CEO of OPR, has added Ogilvy Health to his remit. There's Chief Experience and Innovation Officer Jason Davey, and now there's Chief Operating Officer Dave Sayer. So the four of them together all lead that network as one. And I think that the formation of that network really just, again, feeds into sort of the way that Jens Monsees is consolidating those brands together, strengthening that Ogilvy brand. And I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out with the global links to Ogilvy should the takeover go through. The only other thing I wanted to sort of point out on that note of maintaining that top agency talent, I think the expansion of Richard Brett's remit is an interesting one, and I think it could be an indicator as well of just like adding more to his responsibilities to keep him happy, to make him feel like he's still moving up within the business. Because for something like WPP, such a massive business, if once you get to the top of your respective agency brand, where do you go to from there?
He's been a mainstay at Ogilvy PR, of course, for a few years now. So a good move to keep him in the business and giving him some new roles. I'm going to very tenuously use your VML YNR pointer to go into the next CEO move, where Leo Burnett has announced that Emma Montgomery will be returning to become the Sydney CEO after a stint in Chicago. Now, that's the first Sydney CEO that Leo's has had since Pete Bosulkowski. There's my VML YNR little connection. Of course, he's now moved to Clemenger, Sydney. But interesting move by Leo's to announce a new CEO. Was this something that really had to happen at this stage to get them firing, Tim?
Look, they had a bit of a shot having a national structure. And this is one of those weird things where, for some reason, media agencies don't seem to struggle too much to have a national structure. You know, they'll have a Sydney office, a Melbourne office, sometimes some other sort of, you know, capital city offices as well. But for whatever reason, creative agencies don't usually seem to pull it off. So Melinda Gertz was always seen as a real force in the Melbourne market. And Leo Sydney, when she took that on, it's not necessarily her fault at all, because I think it probably had issues already. But, you know, a weird little insight I got was when Mumbrella was looking for new space with our new owners Diversified, you know, we went and looked at a few office spaces, and we were just being shown around by a real estate guy. And so we wandered in kind of effectively anonymously, and I didn't even realise till I walked through the door, we were shown Leo's Sydney office down in the Rocks. So normally, you know, you get the rah, rah, rah if you come in as a journalist. It just felt dead walking in. There was no roar of culture. There was no atmosphere. We walked out to the back, which looked like the front rather. We looked in a sort of, you know, kind of bit of a corner that seemed like the creative area. And there was someone asleep. You know, it was so unimpressive. And that was probably a year and a half ago, maybe not that long ago. So, you know, definitely it's if they're going to do something, then it's time to fire up, because, you know, you had that wall of Cannes Lions up on the shelf. But when you looked at the dates, they were pretty old.
And to round out this segment, Havas has named Simone Gupta as CEO of Havas PR, adding the leadership of Red Havas to her existing remit as CEO of One Green Bean. The appointment comes after the departure of Sarah Trombretta from Red in February. Zoe, does this mean merger is on the horizon with Red Havas and One Green Bean?
That was one of my first thoughts, and I know it was yours as well, Damo, but I have been assured that, quote, there is no merger planned between Red Havas and One Green Bean. And interestingly, in the release, they were very careful to stress how unique and different the two businesses were, which also made me think, then how do those client conflicts get played out? So the answer to that is that it will get taken on by a case-by-case basis, seeing as Simone will be the only person across the two businesses. It's an interesting one, because there's sort of two ways that I can see this going. When Sarah resigned, they promoted Steve Fontenot from Havas Boulevard, the group's experience and production arm, to MD of Red Havas. And quickly, Simone has taken over the leadership of Red Havas over the top of him. And the way that the release makes it out, I do wonder whether he's getting, you know, raised up to then later become CEO of Red. Otherwise, the other way I see it going is bringing in a managing director of One Green Bean to sit on the same level as him for them to both then report into Simone.
I think the one thing I'd add is that One Green Bean is a really great local PR brand. And once local brands end up inside multinational holding groups, in the end they die.
Next up, Xander is going to chat with Triple M's Mike Fitzpatrick. The Mumbrella Awards are back in person for 2021 to celebrate the best work and talent across the marketing, advertising, media, production, PR and communication sectors. With the first entry deadline on April 9, review the 31 categories, discuss them with your team and start thinking about those submission ideas. Go to mumbrella.com.au/Mumbrella Awards for more information.
So the start of 2021 saw several of Australia's big radio networks reach for the reset button, and a whole stack of new flagship breakfast shows were launched across metro markets. Next week, GFK releases the first radio ratings of the year. But before that happens, head of the Triple M network, Mike Fitzpatrick, joins us on the Mumbrella Cast. Fitzy, thanks for taking the time to have a chat.
No worries, Xander. Thanks for having me on.
Southern Cross Austereo's rock-driven Triple M format is one of the biggest in the country across its network, with stations in regional Australia as well as metro markets. Previously, Triple M's syndicated shows were broadcast on Mix 94.5 in Perth, for lack of a Triple M station there. But in 2021, that all changed, and SCA launched Triple M Perth. We'll get our first look at Perth's ratings performance next week for Triple M, but Fitzy, talk me through a bit of the process of launching your newest radio station.
It's funny, you know, I've worked at Triple M for 3 years, I think, this year, and I've worked at many of the Triple M stations, but I've never, and we've changed a lot of them over from their original brands. You know, we changed KO over to Triple M and 4TO over to Triple M, but I've never launched a brand new Triple M in a metro market. So that was really exciting for a start, to be able to work from the ground up. And in hindsight, what we've been uninhibited by is a lack of real understanding of what the brand stands for broadly in that market. You know, the Triple M existed briefly in Perth before on 96, back in the mid-90s. And it was a pop station then, and, you know, that was 20-something years ago. So really, other than Triple M football and the occasional podcast of our East Coast shows, there hasn't really been a broader understanding of what the Triple M brand stands for. There's certainly been an awareness, but not really an understanding. So we were able to create that brand from the ground up, you know, from the first song we decided to put in the playlist to how we cast the shows, and how we talk to the audience, the type of irreverence and packaging we put on the air. So that was a real a sense of freedom in doing that. And it started with hiring the right content director. And Tim Arnold, who had worked on that frequency previously as the content director of Hit 92.9, had only ever been, you know, he'd worked at Fox and he'd worked at Nova and B105, but he'd never worked at a Triple M before. So I thought what Tim brought was a really fresh perspective on the brand. And true to form, he has been such an amazing, fresh mind on that radio station. His creativity, I think, is second to none. And so what we've got is a really unique sounding Triple M within our brand, you know, our brand parameters. But for some reason, that Triple M Perth just sounds so fresh and new. And it's the same songs and the same ideas, but for some reason, it's got this really nice freshness to it. And I think that's exciting. And you can hear it coming through the speakers as well, from the breakfast show with Basil, Zave and Jenna. And whilst Basil, when we first started, was a given, we knew we wanted Basil. We didn't know what we're going to do with Zave and Jenna. So that really came together as we started to demo the shows. We've got an amazing workday lineup. You know, Dan Leach comes from a Triple M regional in Bunbury, and And Kat Lynch, of course, was at SAFM originally and was a breakfast announcer, but also filling in on Triple M Sydney. We're calling her the Duchess of Rock, and she's really owned that space and has become very quickly one of the best rock presenters in the world. And that's not hyperbole. She really is. And we're blessed on Triple M to have some amazing rock presenters. But she's fantastic. And then, you know, Malloy fits nicely. The new Marty Sheargold show fits nicely. And then to have a locally based and created Rush Hour with Andrew Embley and Lockie Reed is also a benefit. And even our nighttime lineup with Danny Lakey. Danny's from Perth. He grew up in Perth and went to school in Perth. So, you know, he's a local. So it's a really exciting and fresh lineup on what is essentially a new brand in Perth.
Yeah, and you mentioned Basil there. I mean, that was going to be my next question. Obviously, a big name personality in the Perth market. Was leading it with a big name like him something that was always going to be key to doing something like this? And was waiting around for the right person one of the reasons why we haven't seen Triple M Perth launch before now, really, in its current form?
I think the reason we haven't seen a Triple M launch in Perth before was the success of Mix 94.5 as such a strong brand and a strong strong performing radio station from both a revenue and a ratings point of view. And it, because it was part of the Triple M network, it hadn't really been considered until Dave Cameron and I were talking last year around, you know, the potentials in Perth. And it really highlighted this to us that whilst Mix was part of the Triple M network, it was a real disparity between our brand fit and that brand. And it always lent itself more to the hit network. And I always felt there were kind of like two hit stations, just a slightly older one and the younger one. So launching Triple M with a name like Basil, to answer the first part of your question, was not part of the strategy initially. It was, can we put a Triple M into Perth? And then it became, how can we create a breakfast show that's going to be different from every other show? You know, that's how I like to program. I don't like the program to be better. I like the program to be different, because in my opinion, different wins. And, you know, better is so subjective. Different is not. And Basil just made sense. He was, you know, for all intents and purposes, an Eddie-style character in Perth and was able to bring something different to radio that didn't exist over there, which is a relevant, news-based, what's happening in Perth today-style show. And one of the KPIs we put on the show is, if I can take the show and replay it in any other market on any other day, then it's failing. It needs to be relevant to the day and it needs to be relevant to the market. So much so that if I come in and don't understand what you're talking about because it's so Perth, then you're doing a good job.
Yeah, fair play. And are you committed to giving that show at least a couple of years to bed in, carve out a chunk, get attribution, all those sorts of things?
Of course. There's no point putting shows in and then knee-jerking. I think we've demonstrated, certainly on the Triple M network over the years, that commitment to shows and loyalty to shows pays off. You know, we had an 11-year run with the Hot Breakfast. We had a 10-year run with the Grill Team. We've had an 11-year run with the Rush Hour in Melbourne. Roo and Ditz have had 7 years in Adelaide. Marto's been on Triple M Brisbane for 20 years. You know, we don't need you. We know that the audience likes familiarity. And when we find something that works, we keep it. And when we find something that doesn't quite resonate, we find a way to help it achieve what it needs to achieve. It's really easy for people to look at ratings and go, 10 plus, you know, you're not rating 10 plus. But anyone that's really judging the success of their show on a 10 plus and not digging down into the figures is not being honest. You know, 10 plus, you can be number one 10 plus and have no share over 25 and all of you shared, you know, 10 to 24. It's a false economy. We really look at the numbers and our target demos and how we make, write the most revenue as a business, and that's what matters for us. So we'll absolutely give it the time.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned Eddie Maguire. It was a show in Melbourne that was really a game changer when it launched in 2009. That's something that you've mentioned before as well. Marty Sheargold, obviously a great talent, but just reflecting back on Eddie and that show and the various people that came through that show, what are your thoughts on the show that legacy will leave for Australian radio when we look back on it, perhaps when, you know, its departure isn't quite as raw as it is right now?
I think it will always be regarded as one of the great radio breakfast successes, because it really did remind people that FM radio didn't just need to be, and I use the term I want to use a term, I'm trying to find a way to say this that's not going to offend everybody. It made us realize that FM radio didn't just need to be trite. And I'm not saying that we always created trite radio, but we did try hard a lot of the time. And it could be a really lean in, what's happening right now, relevant experience. So to the point that when we first started that show, the number one complaint we got was if I wanted to listen to news and talk back, I'd listen to AM. It was so uncommon to hear a show like that on FM, and I think that's its legacy. It proved that radio is radio no matter where you are or what platform you're on, and as long as you're engaging and being relevant to your audience, that's what matters.
Yeah, and on its replacement, Marty Sheargold, how did that come about? I know you've spoken a little bit about this before. Were there any other names on the table for that show? And I guess after a tough few years in the ratings, not necessarily in general, but compared to the numbers that Eddie was putting up a few years back, is Marty the man to get Triple M Melbourne back to, I guess, where Eddie had it a few years ago?
Well, to my point earlier, if you're just looking at 10 plus, then yeah, you would say that. But the thing to remember is Eddie smashed our target demos every day of the week. You know, it's no secret that we generally target men between 25 and 54, that's just where our format leads. You know, in rock, sport and comedy leans male, but 40%, and often in some markets, 45% of our audience is female. It doesn't mean that audience can't enjoy our product, but, you know, the way that we're set up is to win men hands down and deliver that audience for our advertisers. And Eddie did that every day of the week and smashed them. The 10 plus is a bonus, you know, it's an ego number, really. It's nice to be able to say we're number one 10 plus, but it's not what we judge the show on. Can Marty deliver that? Absolutely. Otherwise, we wouldn't have put him in there. Is he going to do it straight away? No. I'd be surprised and happily surprised if that happens on survey day. But I think, to your point, we need to give shows time and we need to give time for the audience to find the show. There are very few shows in radio that can do what Alan Jones or Kyle and Jack did, which is take the audience with them immediately. Marty's is a new show. It's not the show he did at Nova. It's not the show he did previously at Triple M. It's a brand new show. It's called the Marty Sheargold Show. It has a new cast around him. It has a new team around him. And it's finding an audience again that haven't experienced him for a while. And if you're an audience that's tuning into Triple M to experience news and football, as you were with the Hot Breakfast, you're not going to get that with Marty. So there'll be a lot of churn. And we're fully prepared for that. And we expect it. And Marty is really able to sit back and understand that as well. In fact, he's the one that said this is going to take a while, and we all agree on that. It'd be wonderful to see numbers up early that indicate, he's going to be a huge success. But we'll just be watching our key demos and our target demos and using our ears. And my ears tell me it's going to be a great show. It's funny. Every break is funny. And it is really engaging, and it sounds like nothing else on radio. Dynamically, it sounds different from every other show in Melbourne.
Yeah, and I guess just looking at how listener habits changed more broadly during COVID, we saw the sorts of trends like a higher desire for news. Do you think we'll see a shift back to music-driven stations in the ratings over the first 6 months of this year? And you know, how if so, how will that benefit Triple M?
You know, the COVID thing is interesting. We obviously saw a real swing towards streaming during COVID with more people working from home. Radio, I've always said radio solves a problem for people, and depending on what your problem is, that's, you know, you want to be the radio station that solves that problem for that person. If you're a sports station, you're solving a problem for a person who wants to hear about sport nonstop. Do I think the return to work and post-COVID will benefit radio? I think that there will be some people who have discovered online listening and streaming for the first time that will continue to stream now as their primary way of accessing radio content. I think during the COVID period, people discovered podcasting. A lot of people that may not have discovered podcasting is looking for content. And so we've seen audio on demand, downloadable audio on demand content grow, and you know, our latest investment and turn to streaming via the listener platform is hopefully demonstrating that to the industry, that we believe in this content and we believe this is where the audience is. We've seen it with our own eyes, and I think you know, with more people in cars and less people on public transport, every city I talk to and every city I'm in, I see that the roads are filling up again worse than they were before. That's only going to benefit radio. And radio is radio, whether it's live and in the moment or it's on podcast or it's streaming on a phone or in a smart car, it, to me, is irrelevant. The platform is irrelevant. It's just a way of accessing the content that we create. And we've seen across the world consumption of audio content increase. And I can't see any reason why that would go backwards. Especially, you know, the thing that we don't give everyone credit for is, yes, audiences have come to podcasting during COVID, but also the amount, the quantity of quality podcasting that exists in the world now is exponentially larger than it was 12 months ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. You know, we've seen that people are leaning into creating quality podcasts. There were already hundreds of thousands of podcasts, but now there's more higher quality podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. And just coming back to a point you mentioned before about the importance of localism, and you mentioned the importance of having that local rush hour show, local breakfast show, in building up the Perth radio station. I just wanted to talk to you about localism in terms of Triple M's regional offerings. I spoke with Grant Blackley last week about SES financial results, particularly the fact that in the second half of last year there was growth in regional radio revenue. And while he said the company won't be bringing back its hit network local breakfast shows, he did say that Triple M will continue to offer that. Can you guarantee that Triple M's breakfast shows will remain in the regional markets they're in for the foreseeable future? And I guess what's the perspective from your point of view on the importance of regional localism to Triple M and the brand in general?
It's incredibly important, right? You know, I'm a country radio boy. I started in country radio when I was 15 years old, and I listened to country radio every night as growing up as a kid. And I understand and appreciate the importance of those communities being able to access local information. As newspapers aggregate more and more national content and remove locally printed mastheads and move online, and TV networks move away from local news and more to national news, and online sites aren't able to deliver what's happening in their communities other than via Facebook groups, it's really now more important than ever that we provide local news services and local content and access to local shows and information. Now, obviously, that information and news is going to come through mainly in breakfast shows. It's no secret that we network regional workdays in some stations, but where we're required to, in terms of, and by required, I don't mean by ACMA, I mean required to because the town demands it or the community demands it. If there's a flood, if there's a cyclone, if there's local breaking news, we go local on those stations and we cover that. We have the staff there. It doesn't mean we don't do it. We lean into local, and even more so with listener. You know, we're creating local minicasts and content and local news content. And it's important to us that local content be available both in a linear live fashion on FM and AM radio, as well as an on-demand platform. So we'll be continuing to create local content where we can. And while ever we have those, that obligation in those markets.
Yeah, fantastic. And any last minute predictions for the first ratings next week, or is that tempting fate asking you that?
it's anyone's. I don't know. If I could predict the future, then I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. I'd be sitting in a, you know, at the back of a small business somewhere with a crystal ball and a tea towel over my head.
Fair enough. Well, Fitzy, thank you so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate it, and best of luck for next week.
Xander, thank you, mate. Nice to see you.
And that's it for this week. But before we go, Mumbrella 360 returns face-to-face this July with three venues, four streams, and the most forward-thinking leaders in the Australian industry. With a focus on local challenges and opportunities, hear the latest knowledge and experience the networking opportunities you need to make the most of 2021. Whether you're a brand, agency, or media owner, this is an event not to be missed. Book your early bird tickets now and save $300 at mumbrella.com.au/mumbrella360. That's it for this week, though. Thanks, everyone, for joining me.
Thanks, Damo.
Thanks.
Thank you.